You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest today is Jonathan Martin. Jonathan is a writer, speaker, and dreamer living in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he serves as teaching pastor at Sanctuary Church. He holds degrees from the Pentecostal Theological Seminary and Duke Divinity School. He's the author of Prototype, What Happens When You Discover You're More Like Jesus Than You Think. His new book is How to Survive a Shipwreck. Help is on the way, and love is already here. Jonathan, thanks for coming back on the show, man.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Shane. I love being on before, and really is an honor to be back.
How old were you when you founded Renovatus?
Wow, I was, 27.
I was talking with, Brian Zahn was on not that long ago, and I think he founded his church when he was like 23.
Right.
When I helped plant our first church that I was the pastor of, I was 24. There's something about being that young, and 27 is also that young, and planting a church that really, it gives you an identity as a kind of a wunderkind who can, you know, accomplish great things at a young age. And then also I think it's viewed as really an altruistic thing that at that young age you would devote your life to something like that. It seems like that really became kind of part of your identity and who you saw yourself as.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. I mean, I started full-time ministry when I was 22, essentially the day after I graduated. And, you know, I was in youth ministry full-time for 6 years before that, at a very large church before. And it was like, yeah, everything in terms of paving the way for founding Renovatus, yeah, I feel like that was all, in so many ways, the defining story of my life. It's like that everything that it requires of you to carve something out of the ground that did not exist before, all that it brings out of it, you know, it just felt like you kind of by necessity just pour not just blood, sweat, and tears, but kind of like your whole soul into this thing to where it, yeah, I think at least in my case, it felt fairly synonymous in many ways with me.
It seems like for you, there's no lack of earnestness
right
at the time. I don't know about you, but for me, I feel very, very naive when I look back at my former self starting a church. And I didn't have the experience you did when we started. And also, I should say, your church was extremely successful in the, you know, external metrics, but also internal. Like, it seems like Renovatus was a really loving place where a lot of life change happened. Mm. And it seems like it also was, you know, fairly large in number too. Is that right?
Well, you know, it was never a mega church. Like, it wasn't enormous. But yeah, I did feel like but it definitely grew externally. And I did feel like it was a fundamentally healthy thing, insofar as, like you say, just being a place that had been a safe space for so many people, and that it was much more about making disciples and deepening lives than it was, you know, just sort of becoming this empire or whatever. It felt like a very pure thing in that way. I mean, of course, a thousand things that I feel like now that I did wrong or would do differently, but like you say, in terms of just earnestness, being this heart on sleeve, I mean, it was about all the things that we said it was about. That was for sure.
You know, the book is about kind of finding the metaphor and using the story of Paul being shipwrecked to describing, you know, your life in the last several years. And I asked those questions about, you know, your church and how young you were and that identity, because it seems like that's really, you know, that kind of set you up for the shipwreck in a way.
Yeah, you know, I think that's true. Although at the same time, you know, it's like, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that planning a church and ministry leadership in general heightens everything, personifies everything. You know, it's sort of like all the normal life stuff that happens to people. I think, you know, there's so much is kind of happens on this slightly larger, grander scale, just because of the sort of scrutiny that comes with that, you know. So there's a lot of things, and I think a lot in so many ways that's unhealthy. But at the same time, I think in some ways now, and this is pretty new, I don't know if I would have said this even 6 months ago, I think in some ways, like, a lot of the stuff that even I would have said before, you know, about ministry and relationship to ministry that may have set me up, especially for shipwreck. And now in some ways, I just think, I don't know, I think a lot of that's, if you've read Richard Rohr's Falling Upward, and that, you know, I read that in a critical moment kind of during my whole season. In fact, I described the sabbatical in the book when I went to the Spiritual Retreat Center in California. I don't talk about this in the book, but I was reading Falling Upward at the time, and it was life-saving. And that set me on this journey of reading things like the poet Robert Bly's book, Iron John, and which is this really interesting treatment of masculinity and all these other things. But all of that to say, kind of using the terms framed by people like Bly and Rohr and sort of drawing from Jung and all that, I feel like a lot of it is just pretty vintage first half of life stuff. You know, you build and build and build. You're building your ego. You know, climbing. And you do what you do because it's all that you know to do. I think some of those things, while they might be heightened by vocational ministry, are pretty common for somebody with even just with a certain kind of upbringing. I mean, the fact that I was kind of came up in such a religious environment, preacher's home, I feel like in a lot of ways I sort of, because I was always so serious and so studious, almost kind of skipped adolescence. Yep. You know, I think all of that creates a perfect storm. And, you know, and a cocktail that might have been there if I'd have just been, I don't know, you know, like cutting lawns for a living, you know what I'm saying?
Sure, yeah.
But then again, are wildly out of proportion, kind of in the ministry spotlight.
You know, there's this great line from Mad Men. Did you ever watch Mad Men?
No, which I feel like is like a reproach on my character because all my friends love it and tell me I would love it. I feel delinquent that I still watch it.
We'll let it slide. There's this great line that has stuck out, and I really thought of it while I was reading How to Survive a Shipwreck, where the main character Don, who, you know, he's in advertising, and he says, there are people out there who buy things. Something happened. And the way that they saw themselves, he said, something happened, something terrible. And the way that they saw themselves was gone forever. Mm. And so, you know, for him, knowing that insight into people's psyche made him a better ad exec because he exploited that to tantalize people and let them know, hey, there's a way to go back there. If you just buy one more thing. I think there's something so universal about us being self-aware and getting a picture of who we are in our own heads in how people see us, and then being that person saying this is who we are, and so that when things happen that are contrary to that persona, it leaves us adrift.
Absolutely, yes, and I think especially when, you know, you are sort of still clinging on to your innocence. And yeah, I don't know. I just think, and of course, in the world of vocational ministry, there's never any shortage of people to kind of reinforce those things that you want to believe about yourself in a lot of ways. Yep, and I think, I don't know, I just think I've probably never really had the resources. I was never good at confronting the dark side of things, you know, to begin with. I don't think I've ever been good at, I don't know. I think I'm a little bit pain avoidant by nature and relentlessly optimistic, even to myself, you know. And I think because again, as much as I've engaged the world in a really earnest way, I think I spin a lot of things to myself. And you have a lot of reasons to want to believe, you know, these certain mythologies about your own life.
So, you know, in the book, the book was different than what I expected in that you give, you know, some of the brief facts about what the shipwreck was for you in your life. But it was more about the blueprint of how to survive a shipwreck in the life rather than more of an autobiographical journey of yours. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely it does.
with what you want to share, do you want to just tell a little bit about what your shipwreck was?
Yeah, I would. I'm glad to do that, really. Well, and it's kind of, you know, and even to sort of to answer the question and to speak to that a little more broadly, too. You know, I really struggled because over the course of, I guess the better part of 2 years, there were a lot of different versions of this, a lot of things that I wrote. And I struggled with what the best approach would be because, you know, there's definitely like, there existed before what just felt like this more kind of balls to the wall. I think it's as vulnerable in its final form as it ever was in a lot of ways. But I feel like in some ways, trying to kind of get to the heart and to the kernel of, I don't know. I just feel like in some ways, the things that I came to see about the Lord and about life that were so, redemptive, like that was really the interesting stuff. And yeah, that almost yeah. like the further that I got away from some of those things, it was more that I came to see that, like, you know, while I want to be able to own my own story and certainly own my own failures, that some of that, I don't know, it's just not especially novel. I don't remember who it is I first heard say, you know, some variation of the phrase, there's nothing especially original about original sin, you know, it's kind of like, so that's kind of speaking the first thing first, but in terms of, you know, just sort of context of my own story. Yeah. I mean, essentially, I had gotten just very inappropriately emotionally connected with another person and, relationship that crossed boundaries in that way. And as that kind of came up between my wife and I, we were in a really dark place and we took some time away from ministry to try to sort that and to try to work on us. And, then went back into it at the church, and rather than things kind of getting better, in many ways they continue to get worse, and it kind of pulled out a lot of things, and there was so much stuff that was going on in me. And so I think trying to continue to pastor the church while the most fundamental relationships of my life were in disarray and my own heart was so unsorted, you know, I really felt like I was headed towards a nervous breakdown. I mean, I was not handling it. I just wasn't. And I felt like at that point, there was just such a sense of duty and obligation that was keeping me afloat, because I do just to this minute so sincerely love the people of that church and of that community, and I wanted to be there for them. But, you know, it's like I finally had to come to a place, I think, of realistically acknowledging my own limits and having some slow but sure, I felt like, even revelations from the Lord that were very gracious to kind of say, like, hey, it's, in essence, it's okay for you to be a human being and to deal with human stuff. So, you know, that led to stepping away from the church, and that all led into very painful divorce and all these things that would have been historically completely unthinkable to me. I was married for 16 years, no kids. But yeah, like all of that, just not stuff I could have even conceived before. And I think that just the relational stuff and then walking away from the church, you know, I found myself at 36 living in my parents' house doing some ghostwriting and odd jobs and randomness at a little card table in my dad's glorified tool shed that he had kind of transformed into like a workshop for his model trains. So it was a very, very different space in my life. And I don't know, it was sort of like all of my worst fears realized, all the things I most could not have conceived of dealing with. And yet at the same time, it was like, in some ways, for the first time in my adult life, I felt like I had permission to be a Christian in some really fundamental ways, to just find out what it was to just sort of cling to Jesus and to have a year and a half or so to just to attend a wonderful Episcopal church where I wasn't presiding over the table, but the one who was just receiving, you know, and just coming to see these things about God and life that I think you can only see from the underside, which is never really a perspective I've been in before. So, not to over answer the question, but yeah, that's sort of, that's, I guess, sort of the broad strokes of my shipwreck.
one of the themes that I picked up on in the book was you really learning how to receive help.
Yeah.
I think that's got to be so difficult, especially for pastors and ex-pastors, and even just people who want to be good Christians who are really trained on the idea of being Jesus to the world. It's
right.
Sometimes really, really difficult to let people be Jesus to you.
Yeah, I hate it. I don't like that posture at all. I mean, I kept coming back to the image in Mark 5 of the lame man whose friends carry him to Jesus, because I felt like I didn't even have the strength to carry myself in the presence of God in some ways. Just felt so useless in that regard. But I tell you, it's like, it's the worst thing that can happen. And yet in so many ways, it's so transformative too. I think I referenced this briefly in the book, but one of the things that I read during that season that actually was really transformational for me, I read a book called The Grace in Dying by Catherine Dowling Singh. Mm-hmm. And she's Buddhist herself, but she draws a lot from Christian theology and Christian mystics, but essentially a PhD hospice worker who's walked with hundreds of people through the dying process. And the sort of, I mean, there's so much about that book that's brilliant, but the kind of core insight that for me was just life altering, and even the hence the title, The Grace in Dying, is that her thesis is essentially that if people are given time to die, like if they don't die in some kind of sudden tragic way, if there's a dying process, no matter how old the person is, where they come from, what their culture, religion, whatever, then what you see over and over again, whether it's for a long period of time or it can be very, very short, is that if people have time to die, is that there is this incredible clarity that comes, and there is this quality of life that's unprecedented. And what she essentially chalks this up to is that we're so dependent on ego. So much of our life is lived from the ego, our kind of, which is an evil, but more our perception of ourself as opposed to the true self. And her thesis essentially is that what dying does, if nothing else in life does it, is it strips the ego bare in all the ways that we don't want. So in that process, of course, there's going to be anger and there's going to be denial and there's going to be tears and rage and all of that. But that once you kind of work through that process, again, whether it's for a short or long period of time, that there is just this incredible freedom that comes, because finally you're transcending the ego. Because your body's shutting down, you have to be dependent on people around you. You're kind of able to finally live as sort of a unified self, as opposed to being so conscious about self. And that whole insight for me was so extraordinary, because I felt like in many ways that's what was happening to me, is that while I wasn't dying physically, this very much in every other way, well, you know, was a death. It felt like a stripping away. It felt like a stripping of the ego. And I feel like there was all these parallels in that, like all of the stages of grief were there. And yet the further I was getting through the process, the more I felt like I was getting glimpses of that same kind of shimmering freedom that she describes in the book too.
So for the past 3 weeks, I've been talking with InterVarsity Press author C. Christopher Smith about his new book, Reading for the Common Good, How Books Help Our Churches and Neighborhoods Flourish. One of your chapters in Reading for the Common Good is called Deepening Our Roots in Our Neighborhoods. How do you think how does that connect between, you know, being a good neighbor and being an asset to our neighborhood?
On one hand, it's kind of the education function of teaching our neighbors to read and to read well and to read for the common good, to read in ways that draw us deeper into the life of the place. But the other sort of function is kind of the library function of helping our neighbors have the resources. So in a lot of places, that would mean churches kind of working alongside already existing public libraries. And how can churches help support the work of literacy and cultural literacy of the public libraries?
That was C. Christopher Smith talking about his new book, Reading for the Common Good, How Books Help Our Churches and Neighborhoods Flourish. Remember, you can win a copy of this book this week. Just leave a comment on the post at missioalliance.org. The post is missioalliance.org/podcast/Jonathan Martin. And I'm happy to announce the winner from last week's contest. It's Sean Leischer. Sean, thanks for participating. I'll be in touch with you to get your book to you. Thanks a lot, and good luck to everyone this week. I wonder if it was difficult for you after the fallout, after the shipwreck, to not immediately start getting a plan together, like to, you know, whatever, build another boat to like just salvage the situation.
Yeah. And it was, it was funny. It was difficult. And yet I think there was so much pain and such a sense of, so often I felt like the world felt like there were just car bombs going off around me all the time. Like literally my ears would be ringing. And I, it's like I was in no position to think with any clarity. Like, I don't know what kind of plan I could have made. But yes, I feel like I should have been making one. I feel like I was supposed to be making one. And really in no place to do it. I had a stretch for sure where I thought, maybe the best thing for me would be to do something else. But it also felt like, the kind of the further along I went, the more convinced I became that a lot of these things, even after you begin to separate some of the unhealthy over-identification with ministry for identity, that, man, these are things that are in me to do. These are things that I'm called to do. But I never felt like there was a path. I never felt like there was a trail. It felt like so much like every day was just one foot in front of the other and just trusting somehow that God would do the thing that God always does in terms of bringing beauty out of chaos. So that's what kind of led to my friend Ed Gunger's invitation for me to move to Tulsa and to come on at Sanctuary and be part of the community here, which initially I resisted for quite a while simply because I couldn't conceive of living away from home. I couldn't conceive of living away from Charlotte and family and all that. So it was like everything felt like it was fueled by desperation in some way, as opposed to any sort of like meticulous planning. But yet I think that is part of the gift of those kind of times, is that there's a different kind of trust that you learn when you're not really in a place to make plans, and the plans that you do make simply don't work.
It kind of reminds me, to use a really extreme example, it reminds me of like a politician who's caught up in a scandal. Maybe it's like drugs or an affair or what have you, and they have to resign, and they make a statement and they're going to go to rehab and they're going to do this and they're going to do that. And then 9 months later, they are announcing their, campaign for new office or something like that. And you think, wow, that was like a lot. That was really quick to learn a lesson and then to, put your life back together and get a plan together. And what I suspect is that from day one, right after the press conference, they were planning out the campaign that they were going to, launch in 9 months. And it seems like part of what you learned was that, and that part of the shipwreck is flailing in the water a bit and spending some time in the depths with the sea monsters before rebuilding the boat or what have you.
Yeah. And I think, although I think in my own case, far from doing any of that perfectly, I feel like it was like I sort of, in my case, I think a lot of it was, my own desperation to find redemption in my own story and to feel like things are moving in redemptive ways. So trying to almost to kind of make that happen. And my experience was I would do these things where, and not things that were necessarily bad to do, but where it's like, okay, I think I'm ready. I think I'm back. And what it was is that same thing that happens when you've been sick with the flu and for a few days, and it's like, and you try to mow the yard and it's
right. Right. Yeah.
And they go, I'm fine. Yep. And then a few feet in, oh, wait a second. I don't feel ready to do this.
I feel horrible. Yeah.
there was a lot of that going on, you know. And still, I think in some ways, you know, realistically, I think that the process of real inner healing is such long, slow work. And which is the fine line, right? Is like, and on the one hand, I talk in the book about how not to survive a shipwreck, that you don't want to like skip past the pain glibly and pretend like nothing's happened and okay, I'm fine. Like that definitely does not work. And yet at the same time, I don't think it's possible or realistic for much of anybody to just kind of, you know, sit around waiting to somehow magically receive some kind of healing or something before you engage the world in a meaningful way again, sure, either. Sure. So I think there's a real balance in that. Cause I know like in my case, I do feel like there were some ways too that engaging my gifts and the things that I feel like I was called to do in the context of a safe community to do that also was a mechanism to receive a lot of healing too.
I think, you know, what I'm trying to point out is what you're saying is, in the metaphor of the shipwreck, that the part of being lost at sea, the part of flailing in the water, that's as much a part of the process and as important as the rescue itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I wish I'd have said it that way, that clearly in the book, because I think it's like you, because I think what happens is that in the flailing is where you come to the end of your own strength, you know? So yes, I think like those kind of messy, even absurd sort of attempts to try to patch yourself up or patch the boat up, you know, and duct tape everything. I think all that's so important. Trying things and failing at them and all of that. It's so incredibly important. And interestingly enough, I think this is in the same way that like Catherine Dowling Singh talks about how dying itself is this kind of graced mechanism in this way. I think it's almost like the flailing itself, the exasperation of your ego, your own strength, your own resources, that is such a huge part of how God saves us, such a huge part of how God transforms us, not by kind of skipping the flailing and kind of pounding at the wave stage, but precisely in the midst of those things, through those things.
And it seems like, too, that's what made you, better is such a reductive word, but it made you better on the other side. I think you made a comment in the book about, you know, after it was all over that you, something like you weren't afraid to die. And it's kind of like you knew, yeah, the shipwreck isn't fun. The flailing in the water isn't fun. But now I know that love can be found in the water, too, and that Jesus can be found in the water, too. And so there's a fearlessness in a way about it.
Yeah, I think what happens is that when you face the things you were most afraid of facing, and you find out, you know, it's the day after, and you say, "Oh my gosh, I'm still here! I can't believe I'm still here, but I'm still here. I'm still alive, and God is still good, and there's still some kind of beauty in the world, and there's still some kind of hope in me, almost despite myself." It's like somehow there's so much less to be afraid of now after staring down some of those things. So I think what happens is that, you know, you develop the resources just to live from your soul in a really, really different way. That kind of a much greater coherence and integration between inner world and outer world, I think, happens in all of that. It's like there's a way that the self just kind of comes together. Those are things that are real gifts. And it's always hard for me to describe because I always say some variation of the same thing. It's like there's so many things that I would do differently, so many things I would change, and yet I would not go back and choose to be any former version of myself before now, because I feel like, you know, the process again brings inside of a person is so redemptive and so important. The way that I see people now, the way that I engage people now, that I engage life in the world, you know, ironically, I feel like in so many ways, I've never been healthier and wasn't capable. It's almost like, you know, until you lose some things that were important to you, you just don't. And in the process, that it's that, you know, the Jesus teaching about losing your life to find it. It's almost like until you've lost yourself in some ways, that you don't really have a self to give. You know, it's like you don't know who you are. And I feel like that's what happens through a process like this. It's just this really relentless process of having to come to terms with who you really are.
Well, and I think that's what I was wanting to ask you is, it seems as though the experience really exposed some things in you that were problematic way before the actual events that caused the shipwreck.
Oh, absolutely. And I just, that's the thing that I think it's so hard for me to know how to articulate to people sometimes, that I just feel like so many of the things that I would now narrate as being most problematic was, you know, kind of my own life was not, you know, it's just not the most recognizable stuff. It's there are things on a deep level that I feel like never were, just stuff that just kind of has to be loved out of you. Perfect love does cast out fear, and having God love you in these monstrous places I talk about in the book. But, you know, at the same time, I will say, and this is the irony, is that while I feel like the shipwreck kind of brings the worst out of you and you have to re-narrate your life and look at some things that are really painful, at the same time, there are these beautiful things that it brings out too. I know I talk early in the book about, and that passage became so significant to me, where Jesus, right before Peter's, of course, you know, is about to deny Jesus three times and all that, they have that conversation at the Last Supper, where after Jesus has already predicted Peter's betrayal, that then he tells him, you know, Satan has desired to sift you as wheat, Simon, but I prayed for you that your faith would not fail, and talks about how on the other side of this he'll strengthen his brothers. And something just clicked to me one day that, like, that Peter, Jesus has already predicted that Peter is going to fail. I mean, that's inevitable. That's going to happen. That's what he's just been talking about. But then he says, I've prayed for you that your faith would not fail. That there's, you know, there's a difference between me failing and my faith failing. Mm-hmm. Like almost this way that while all these external things can happen on the surface and all these things can change. And I think like in Peter's case, here is the worst moment of his life. Here is the worst denial of Jesus, this very public failure and all of that. And yet it's precisely through that that something's happening in a deeper place in him in terms of his faith, where, and again, I think it's that same dynamic, not of God going around those things, but God working precisely through those things in such a salvific way. So I don't know. And so that part was actually sort of a wonderful discovery. For example, I remember my first Sunday after leaving the church, you know, I think there really was a part of me that wondered, like, I had been in vocational ministry for so long, it's all I know, like, what would I do on a Sunday when I don't have to preach? Like, are all these props, is this what, you know, is this the basis of my faith?
Yeah,
is this
yeah.
all there is to my faith? It was almost a pleasant surprise to be like, you know, to be in church the very next Sunday and the Sunday after that and the Sunday after that, clinging all the more, you know, in a way like I never had. Like, I was so hungry to be in church and to be in community. I was so hungry for the Eucharist in a way that I never had been before. It was almost like this sense of like, oh my gosh, I really am, despite all these things, I really am a Christian. Like, my faith is deep. Like, I mean, I'm so flawed, but I am deeply clinging to Jesus in these ways. And that almost was a surprise, is like that connection remained so fast. That they're instead of crumbling. And I just, those are things that, again, I think you can't know until you get to some of those places.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I think that a lot of pastors who are, if they are introspective enough, must have to wonder that, because, you know, just as human beings, we want to be competent at our vocation. And
right.
So when your spirituality is wrapped up in that as well, like, when how good of a Christian you are also connects to how good of a pastor you are.
Yes.
I think you have to wonder, like, am I pursuing God because it'll also make me good at my job, or do I actually believe this stuff?
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah. I think I was maybe on some level always a little bit tormented by those questions. And it was just, and again, not to romanticize any of that either. So it's like, oh, I found I really love Jesus. I mean, it was just more like, this stuff is just so deep in me, just in the same way that, like, Jesus said to Peter, you know, right after he tells him that he's going to fail, that he's prayed for you that your faith would not fail. Like, the faith in me, that which, you know, that I don't produce in myself, which is only a gift, that those things run deeper, that fundamental connection for / longing for God is very primal inside of me. You know, there's nothing noble about that. It's not pious. It's just that, yeah, on some level, there's just some part of me that really recognizes God, wants God, feels seen and known by God. And just to find all those things getting only deeper through that process has been such a just an astonishing gift, really.
Do you feel like it's changed the way that you are now as a minister and as a pastor and the way you preach even?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I feel like it's, I think the most fundamental change in some ways is that when you haven't had any real significant experience of pain, and then all of a sudden you do, it sort of wakes you up to life in a different way. I think it's the same thing that happens if I buy a black Toyota, then the next day I'm going to say, oh man, look at all these black Toyotas everywhere. Yeah. It's going to feel like every other car is a black Toyota. And, you know, it's not like there's been a spike in black Toyota sales. You know, it's just that because now that I have one, it's like all just my senses are hyper acute now. You're paying attention in ways that you weren't before. And I feel like just pain is like that. It's like once you've experienced profound pain, all of a sudden you recognize it in people fast. They see it in you. They recognize the pain in you. And you're just awake to all that in a very different way. So I feel like I'm just much more awake to people's real pain and suffering. I feel like I'm able to enter that in a much deeper way. Preaching, I feel like I've always tried to preach from a vulnerable place, but I think that has only gotten, I mean, you know, to the best that I knew how at the time, but I feel like that's certainly only gotten deeper, my own sense of kind of dependence and need for the Spirit and you know, in that way, all of that. But I do think maybe the first and largest thing really has just been when you're just really awakened to pain for yourself, you really are awakened to pain in others in a very different way. So I just think relationally, it changes everything.
Well, Jonathan, and it's just been so good. I hate asking this question because I think it's lazy interviewing, but is there anything else that you feel like we didn't touch on that you want to share?
No, I don't think that's a lazy question at all. I feel like it's a gracious one to me.
Okay, good.
You know, I guess the only thing I would that I would think of to say, just in context of really all the things we've talked about, I just think for me a lot of it has been you just coming to see how much of my life I think now I feel like I lived grasping on to things, and in some ways like grasping on to everything. And there's just this really interesting thing that happens when you feel kind of forced to let go that is so scary because you just, you know, you don't know exactly where the process is taking you. You don't know where life is taking you. You don't know where God is taking you. And I think that's because I just can't stress enough, even the things through all this about God and life and the world that have been really beautiful, I just can't. There's been real suspense in all that because there's so many moments where, okay, I don't know where this story is going. I don't know what's happening to me right now. I don't know what this is doing to me. And in that, there's so many moments of fear. So it's not like it's all been this, you know, oh, wow, this is this really exciting, wonderful adventure. So much of it really is scary as hell. But at the same time, it's like, oh, wow, you know, when you come to find out that you can trust God in those places and that you can trust that God is still working even the most broken things for redemptive purposes, I just think it teaches you to live in a way that's open-handed. It teaches you not to cling and grasp. And I think I'm coming to see that, like, at least in my understanding of the Christian life now, and in a lot of ways, that's everything, is learning how to live in a way that doesn't clench or strive or just cling on to things the way I think I was always so prone to.
It sounds like it is more scary in real time, but it seems like it's also more robust and fulfilling in real time too.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so true. For sure.
Well, Jonathan, the book was so good, and I look forward to sharing it with my friends who are going through their shipwrecks in life. Man, so thanks for opening yourself up in such a specific way, and thanks for being on the show again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Really, it's been an honor, just and a wonderful conversation. Really grateful.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.